When was the last time you experienced joy? Not pleasure, not just a good day, actual joy. Take a moment and think about it. Were you at home or hiking in the mountains? Alone or surrounded by people? Singing, dancing, sitting in total stillness? A few come to mind for me. Walking with my family among the old growth redwoods in Northern California, our necks craned back, speaking in hushed tones like it was some sort of cathedral. Solving the world's problems around a kitchen table with my girlfriends, equally nourished, whether it was belly laughs or quiet tears. Singing at the top of my lungs with 20,000 strangers at the Amble concert in St. Anne's Park. Sitting on a bench beside Lake Lugano, undone by the last page of a book I never wanted to end. What do those moments have in common? What is it exactly that makes them joy rather than just a pleasant experience? How is joy different from happiness or pleasure? What do the world's faith traditions have to say about it? And the question that actually brought me here today, is there a way to have more of it? Even now, maybe especially now, in a world that seems more broken by the day. Joy is a slippery thing to define. It's a little like that famous line about pornography. Hard to describe, but you know it when you see it. And often I've noticed it's more apparent in its absence than in its presence. That's certainly how I found my way to the topic. After years of frantic motion, running a freelance business, keeping everyone in clean clothes and reasonably nutritious dinners, driving kids, some of them mine, around in a seven-seater like it was my job, the nest emptied and everything came to a halt. I'm still feeling the whiplash. One minute I had no time, the next I had nothing but time. My days yawning open with unstructured hours and my menopausal nights ending before dawn. I needed more joy in my life, and I needed it fast. So naturally, I attacked it like any reasonable woman with a master's degree would. I started therapy, I read every book in the self-help section, I upped my protein intake, I swapped the morning scroll for meditation. Somehow, it still didn't add up to joy. As the old Yiddish saying goes, man plans, God laughs. So let's start where I started. What actually is joy? The dictionary will tell you it's a feeling of great happiness or pleasure, a deep internal state of well-being and contentment. Christianity ranks it high, literally. Joy is the second on Paul's list of what a spirit-filled life looks like, right behind love. The fact of Christ's salvation is reason enough to celebrate. Even if you are behind bars, like Paul was in Philippi. He sang hymns in his cell, and suddenly an earthquake flung open the prison doors and set him and his fellow prisoners free. Joy can move mountains. For the Buddhists, joy is rooted in a connection with something beyond ourselves. Rejoicing in someone else's happiness, known as mudita, is a trainable kind of joy, as we glimpsed in our meditation earlier. PT, on the other hand, is a more rapturous, thrilling joy, something many practitioners experience alone when they are deep in meditation. In Islam, joy comes with a warning sign. Farah madmum is to be avoided at all costs. This so-called blameworthy joy comes not from God, but from worldly delusions, arrogance, and pride. Fahra Mahmud, on the other hand, is the real deal. This praiseworthy joy rejoices in the grace, guidance, and mercy of Allah, as instructed by the Quran. Judaism skips the red flags and goes in the other direction. Joy isn't so much spontaneous as mandatory. You don't wait around for joy to appear. Jewish festivals like Passover or regular Sabbath worship are designated appointments for joy. So according to the ancient texts, joy is both a feeling and a state, a surprise and a scheduled event. an internal feeling and an external command, clear as mud. If the gallons of ink spilled on the topic is any indication, today's spiritual gurus also believe that joy is in the eye of the beholder. Annie Lamott says that joy is the best makeup. Elizabeth Gilbert calls it our birthright, not something we have to earn, but something we enjoy simply by existing. For C.S. Lewis, joy is distinct from aesthetic pleasure in that it always carries what he calls the stab, the pang, the inconsolable longing. Joy for Lewis hurts a little, and it's supposed to. But the definition I keep coming back to is from the theologian Willie James Jennings. He says, joy is an act of resistance against despair and all its forces. As such, rather than a fleeting episode, joy can become a way of life, a daily practice of resisting those things that make life not worth living. Violence, injustice, algorithms, war, complacency, debt, self-doubt, pain. That reframes everything, doesn't it? Joy isn't the absence of despair, it's the antidote to despair. Being joyful doesn't mean ignoring the possibility of loss or wishing away the reality of scarcity and suffering. It is instead rooted in the peace that comes from the awareness, from the acceptance of our powerlessness in this life. We are still alive, despite it all, and there is joy in that. We are all Eric Idle, whistling on his cross, looking at the bright side of life for as long as he can. So if joy is indeed available and built into the architecture of life, then why do so many of us go for weeks and months without touching it? And how can we cultivate more of it? One promising technique is to identify your personal joy killers and then work to remove them, which should, in theory, make more room for joy. There seem to be a few repeat offenders in my life. Perfectionism and the cult of busyness are high on that list. I cringe when I think of how much joy I kept from my family by trying to be the perfect parent. Running behind the kids with a brush and dustpan rather than just letting the glitter fly. Racing against the clock instead of making time for unstructured play. Gravitas and self-righteousness, the kind that turn religion into fundamentalism, are poison for joy. Jack Kornfield talks about how he took his quest to master Buddhism so seriously and was so focused on teaching about suffering and enduring hours of long, arduous meditation that he failed to appreciate the riot of culture in the Buddhist temples and the rituals of dance and feasting and celebration that were part of temple life. He reminds us of the Rumi quote, "Do not sit long with sadness, my friends. When you enter a garden, do you look at thorns or flowers? Spend more time with the roses and the jasmine." And then there's the whole family of self-preoccupation, self-centeredness, self-satisfaction, self-hatred, all different flavors of the same trap. All of them keeping your attention locked on yourself instead of open to the world. Knowing that we share the reality of suffering with all living things enables us also to share with them our joy. So is there anything we can do to invite more joy into our lives besides decentering these joy killers? According to the Dalai Lama, we first have to recognize our capacity for joy and quiet our critical monkey minds. In the Book of Joy, he says, "Sadly, most of what undermines our joy, we manufacture ourselves. It comes from the mind's negative tendencies, from our emotional reactivity, from a basic failure to notice and use the resources we already have inside." Mindfulness and self-reflection are helpful here. Byron Katie says something similar from a different angle. When you argue with reality, you always lose. And one of the first things you lose is joy. Because now you're locked in a ferocious argument against life on life's own terms. And that becomes your entire identity. Accepting reality as your default is where joy can actually begin. Her technique, known as the work, is a very effective tool. Kate Ballard doesn't accept that joy is a choice. If joy is just another choice, she says, it becomes yet another way to blame ourselves when life hurts. There's no amount of positive thinking that will summon it on command. Joy refuses to obey us. It interrupts. It strikes when you least expect it. A call at exactly the right second. Your song on the radio. A random interaction with a fellow human. I was in the park last week and I was walking with my dog who always collects these massive sticks. And a man came across us and he said, "Oh, look, what do we got here?" He's the branch manager. And then he said, "And that makes you the assistant branch manager." And I was like, what a great, and I thought if we had both had our earphones on, you know, we wouldn't have had that interaction. And it was a moment of joy that I hope comes again soon. So maybe we shouldn't wake up each morning determined to choose joy, despite what some Instagram influencer might say. But I, like Kate, believe we can do our part to put ourselves in the way of joy. Slowing down long enough to take the call, looking up instead of at your phone, leaving a little unscheduled room in a life built to fill every space with productivity. You can't command yourself into joy, but you can become the kind of person who's ready to receive it. Before we go further, I want to name something that might already be sitting uncomfortably with some of you. Isn't there something a little off about standing here talking about joy when the world is literally on fire? When people are starving, fleeing, dying, losing their homes? Shouldn't we be talking about rage instead, or action, or at the very least, grief? I want to hold two ideas here because I think they can coexist, even though they pull in opposite directions. The first is this. It's often the most privileged among us who seem to have the least access to joy. We build bigger houses, and yet we never feel at home. We accumulate more and laugh less. Seneca saw this coming 2,000 years ago. Writing on The Happy Life, he put it plainly, "Some people are miserable not for a lack of pleasures, but precisely because of them." Comfort and wealth, it turns out, are no guarantee for joy. And the second is this. Joy has never been a luxury reserved for people whose lives are easy. If anything, history suggests the opposite. That joy shows up most fiercely exactly where it seems most out of place. At the hospital, on the battlefield on Christmas Eve, in line at the post office, among people with the least reason to expect it, yet often the most likely to need it. The Dalai Lama knows something about this. On the night he fled Tibet in 1959, the army closing in, the real possibility that a single slip-up would get him killed, he called on a verse from the 8th century Buddhist master Shantideva to steady him. If there's a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for dejection? And if there is no help for it, what use is there in being glum? Not because the danger wasn't real, it was, but because despair in that moment wasn't going to save him. And joy, with its stubborn insistence that life is still worth living, just might. He is my poster boy for joy, the Dalai Lama. In the book of joy, the way he and Bishop Tutu are so silly and so ridiculous, it just makes your heart sing, especially for people who have endured as much as they've endured. That brings me to the question I really want to ask this congregation. Are we saying yes to joy? Not just receiving it privately, but turning it outward into resistance. Into something that speaks truth to power precisely because it refuses to let despair be the final word. History is full of people who have used wit and joyful expression to call out injustice. There's Mary Maloney, the suffragette who followed Winston Churchill around from campaign stop to campaign stop in 1908, ringing a bell every time he tried to speak, drowning him out with pure, deliberate noise. There's Monstration, a May Day flash mob in Russia started by artist Artyom Loskutov in 2004, where activists hold up deliberately nonsensical signs like bees against honey or do not conceal Tahiti to indirectly defy the government and dare officials to arrest them. There are the clowns of the anti-racist action group who crashed a neo-Nazi rally in full red-nosed regalia in 2007, tossing white flour into the demonstration every time they heard the words white power. There are the mariachi bands that play outside the hotels where ICE officials are staying, contrasting cruelty with a dance party. And perhaps my favorite, Harry Smith Haggett in the UK, a self-styled guerrilla gardener who plants flowers in huge potholes to draw attention to the city council's poor record in street maintenance. So is this something we could do too? When I think about this congregation, I think we're better positioned than most to use joy as a tool of resistance. This room is full of writers, artists, musicians, academics, and if our coffee hour conversations are any indication, it's also full of some genuinely wickedly funny people. We used to write letters to prisoners of conscience through this church's Peace and Justice Initiative. Small, stubborn acts of hope mailed out into the dark. Maybe it's time to bring something like that back. A billboard campaign, open letters, a mariachi band of our own, if it comes to that. I don't know exactly what it looks like yet, but I know this congregation has the raw material. And I know that joy, born of our spiritual seeking and deployed with a strong sense of purpose, can still move mountains. Amen.